a Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen versus Union Pacific Railroad Company.
May it please the court. I'm Tom Gagan. I'm the lawyer for the plaintiff appellant, BLE. I'd like to make two points in this oral argument that stress points that are already made in the brief. But the first and perhaps the most important point is that the Union and Union Pacific, the BLE and Union Pacific, held conferences about every one of these five discharge cases, which were dismissed by the board on a procedural technicality without a hearing. We conferenced every single one. When the notice of intent by the Union was filed, by Union I mean BLE, not Union Pacific, was filed, Union Pacific did not raise any objection that there had been a failure to follow this grievance step. And when the documents were submitted that listed the relevant argumentative facts and the evidence in support of it, there was never any claim by Union Pacific that these cases had not been conferenced. Of course they had been conferenced. And if you read the arbitration awards, Union Pacific never argues that these cases were not conferenced. All they argue, and this is an argument that comes up at the hearing stage, essentially the same sort of stage we're at in this particular case, when a lawyer came in and said there's no evidence that there's conferencing in the record, not that the parties didn't conference. Of course we conferenced. There's a 3-year backlog of cases before the NRAB. That means every union that is responsible holds a conference with the employer before these cases go to the NRAB and say, one last time, can we settle this? Can we get this person back to work? So the past practice is that this is usually done by telephone. There's no regulation of it in the collective bargaining agreement. There's no rule as to how it ought to be done. Yes, we conferenced all these cases. And on Rule 12b-6, they accept our well-pleaded allegation. The district court accepts that the conferences occurred, so we complied with the Railway Labor Act. So why this rule? This rule, which has never been applied before, ever, in the 70 years of the history of the NRAB, never applied. This new rule, announced without any prior notice, says that the board will not accept late evidence as to conferencing if the employer raises the objection belatedly, because it has to be in the on-property record down below and submitted to the NRAB before the oral argument begins.
Was this conferencing condition always included in other matters when they came to the board?
There is a statute which this circuit has interpreted numerous times that says that that the parties shall conference in the usual manner, that the collective bargaining agreement controls how the conferencing occurs. And we complied with the collective bargaining agreement, which...
I don't think there's any issue about that there was conferencing, but it wasn't pleaded, I guess, is the problem here.
There is no rule of pleading conferences. The rule that is applied here, in fact, the board came up with a new rule that is not in the Act. There's no rule about pleading conferences in the Act. It's not in Circular 1.
It's sort of like exhaustion, I would suppose, isn't it?
It could be put that way.
If you don't plead exhaustion.
But that's an issue in the collective bargaining agreement. The parties have the entire authority to conference as they please. That's set forth in Section 152, Section 6 of the RLA. And it's set forth in Section 153, first paragraph I, and it's emphatically set forth by this circuit in Ryan versus Union Pacific, where this circuit said that the parties cannot appeal to the RLA or to any regulation or to federal court or anything else, that the collective bargaining agreement, that the past practice, and the circuit was emphatic about that, controls how conferencing should be done and should be pleaded. So where did this rule come from? This rule, the only published rules for the NRAB are set forth in 29 CFR 301.5. And the rule with respect to documentation says as follows. Under caption, position of employees, the employees must set forth all relevant argumentative facts and data submitted in support, that is, in support of these argumentative facts, must affirmatively show the same to have been presented to the carrier and made a part of the particular question in dispute. So, Your Honor, what we're saying here is this rule applies only to data that is submitted in support of argumentative facts. There is nothing in Circular 1, 301.5, not one word about conferencing. There is nothing in 301.5, which was promulgated properly by proper rulemaking back in 1934, that has anything to do with conferencing. And even if it did, and it doesn't, even if it did, this circuit said in Ryan versus Pacific that the RLA has nothing to do with conferencing. The conferencing is what the parties do themselves pursuant to their collective bargaining agreement. So what this board did was apply a new rule that is not in the RLA. It's not in Circular 1301.5. It's not in the collective bargaining agreement. In fact, it's in conflict with the collective bargaining agreement, which says conferencing should be done orally. And the only rule here is one that relates to data that is submitted in support of argumentative facts relating to the appeal. This is a procedural step. It's got nothing to do with that.
Now, let me just take you. I understand your point about the no new evidence rule applying more logically to evidence on the merits as opposed to evidence of a procedural step.
Yes.
But is there anywhere in the rules that these two types of evidence are distinguished, or is the rule simply that the NRAB does not take new evidence outside of the on-property record?
Your Honor, it is distinguished, and it is distinguished in 301.5 itself, which says that the evidence must affirmatively show to have been presented to the carrier. So when the collective bargaining agreement says there are oral conferences, there is no document that is submitted to the carrier. This 301.5 cannot logically apply to evidence as to conferencing that is done orally pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement. If what the board is saying here is not just a rule as to how the evidence has to be presented to the board, but also that from here on, we want to see evidence as conferencing that meets 301.5, which means we want to see evidence that the hearing was transcribed, presented to the carrier, or that there was some exchange of letters, because you can't put anything in the on-property record that was not previously shown to the carrier on the property below. So if you have an oral conference and just put in an affidavit, hey, I conferenced, or that's not good enough. You can't get it in. This is a wacky rule. It's never been applied before. The danger of it is that five engineers are never going to get a hearing on the merits of their case, that we had no notice. We could have complied with this if somebody had told us that this was the rule. No one told us this. And that is the worst part of it. First, there's no authority for this. First, we did conference. Second, there's no authority for this rule. Third, we could have complied if somebody had told us that this was a rule, and there was no reason to toss these cases out for lack of jurisdiction and discharge them on the merits. Any one of a number of things could have been done. Supplement the record, add more time. I see that I'm going into my rebuttal time, but the upshot of this is there's no authority for this under the Act, and the Act is not supposed to interfere with how parties conference anyway. Circular 1 doesn't apply, and we had no notice of it.
Thank you, Mr. Kagan. Mr. Monroe.
Good morning. I'm Donald Monroe for Union Pacific Railroad. I'd like to approach this from the perspective of the legal grounds that a judicial body has to review arbitration awards. There's two that are raised in this case. First, the union has argued that the arbitration awards at issue here are subject to review under 3 First Q because the board lacked jurisdiction to do what it did. My response to that is there is no such basis for review of an arbitration award when you're talking about a procedural or evidentiary ruling of the kind at issue here.
But doesn't it seem patently unfair for the Brotherhood to have been knocked out of the rink on this technical requirement, which it could not have discovered, could not have discovered, even if it had studied each and every statute and regulation governing the NRAB.
That's the second prong, and I think
right.
Everything ultimately boils down to their due process argument. Their whole case is it wasn't fair. It wasn't fair what happened to us. It wasn't fair that we didn't get a hearing on the merits. It wasn't fair that the arbitrator applied this obscure or new rule. Well, there's a innumerable.
Is this the first time this rule was ever applied?
Absolutely not. In the supplemental appendix, we've put together a collection of the awards that were cited by the board. And by the way, the board in this case cites 20 different other arbitration awards.
Yeah, but
as a basis.
Do any of those awards, forgive me, specifically use the words on property record to make it clear that the evidence of the conference must appear in the on property record? Any of those awards?
Yes. Supplemental appendix page 96, supplemental appendix page 97, 104, 112, 115, 118. There's let me read one of them to you, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, because you're going to read it, were there any cases in the awards that are cited on pages 27 and 28 in which both parties conceded that a conference had taken place, or was that a disputed fact in each case?
Well, Your Honor, the board's awards are very clear. This is a long-standing rule that there has to be evidence of the conferencing in the record. Now, I don't know how much more clear the board needs to be about it.
I asked you a very specific question, which is, did both parties concede that a conference had taken place, or was it a disputed fact in each of those cases?
The board's awards don't reveal one way or the other, and it doesn't matter.
Well, doesn't it?
It absolutely does not. If you don't follow the rule, if you don't put evidence in the record that conferencing took place, you are subject to default. That's the rule that the board follows. Moreover, and this is a more fundamental point, this rule that the board follows is not subject to due process attack. It is not the deprivation of due process for the board to come up with procedural rules, even new procedural rules, and apply them as it sees fit in particular cases. The only thing that due process provides in this context is an opportunity to be heard before an impartial arbitrator. That's it.
Yeah, well, you know, I was really interested because, you know, you compared this case to MISCO, and you argued that because of MISCO, we can't review the board's evidentiary rulings. But in this case, the board did not refuse to hear Brotherhood's evidence because it had made some assessment of its relevance or prejudice, as is usually the case in evidentiary determinations. Here, it refused to hear the evidence because it had decided that the evidence was submitted at the wrong time. Doesn't that make it more a jurisdictional decision than an evidentiary decision?
Well, it doesn't really matter, I think, how you characterize it. I mean, the board made a procedural ruling, it made an evidentiary ruling, it made a jurisdictional ruling. It makes no difference. That kind of ruling is not reviewable under
MISCO. So nothing is reviewable?
Well, there's...
Nothing is reviewable?
Virtually nothing is reviewable.
Well, we can go home.
Yeah, you should, Your Honor.
Okay, bye.
The only thing that is reviewable under the jurisdictional prong that has been raised by the appellants here are awards that are wholly irrational, that lack reason, that have no foundation in reason or fact. That's the Gunther standard. There's a million variations on it, but that's the standard one. You can say that this rule was unfair. You can say we didn't know about it. You can't say it lacked reason. It's not irrational. Based on all of these previous decisions that the board cites, to say that it lacked reason to say that they were procedurally defaulted here, absolutely not. Now, and that's why their argument really boils down to their due process argument, saying it's not fair. But as I say, due process doesn't provide the federal courts with unlimited jurisdiction to go in and reassess whether what happened in the arbitration proceeding was fair or not. All the courts have jurisdiction to do is to assess whether they were heard. Did they have an opportunity to be heard on this issue? And they absolutely had that opportunity. It's expressed in the board's award itself. The board discusses their argument, analyzes it, and rejects it. So they had due process. In fact, the one thing that I would suggest about this case is it's an opportunity for the court to clarify that the only thing that is provided in due process review under the Railway Labor Act is what the Railway Labor Act itself already provides. There's a split in the circuits on this issue. I think this is the perfect case in which to clarify that where courts recognize due process review.
Can I explain where logically I'm having a terrible problem? The conference occurs after the initial on-property process, where the bulk of the evidence is gathered. It seems so odd to me to require parties to include the on-property record information about what happened after the on-property process. Do you see where my problem is?
Yes, Your Honor. The on-property record does not close until the grievant files the notice of intent. And there's an on-property process, then there's the statutorily required conference, and then the notice of intent is filed. So as a practical matter, Your Honor, and those of us who practice before the NRAB do this 100 times a year, what you do is, after you have your conference, before you file your notice of intent, you send a letter to the other side saying, thanks for meeting with us in conference, we couldn't agree, and we're just letting you know we're going to file our notice of intent. Happens every day. And the people who handle these things for the unions and for the railroads, they know this stuff. I mean, this is their own little world. They practice in this area exclusively. This is not a surprise. This is not unusual. This is the standard way it's done. And it's easy to do. And they've admitted they could have done it. Mr. Gahagan admitted it again today. They could have put this into the record, and they didn't. And they were procedurally defaulted as a result. And that decision...
They didn't because they didn't know about your rule.
Well, that's just malpractice, Your Honor. As I say, there are dozens of decisions on this point. If the evidence of the conferencing is not in the record, you lose. If I had been representing the union, I would be subject to suit for malpractice. I see my time is just about up. Are there any other questions that I can address?
Any other questions?
I have 1,000, but I can't.
I'm happy.
Judge has 1,000, she says, but we're not going to go quite that far today. Do you want to have
I'm glad I never had to practice in this area. It's very difficult, I think.
It's an unusual area, yeah. And that's why the people who practice in this area are steeped in this stuff. The Supreme Court has said this is a world unto itself.
Are brilliant.
No, I'm afraid not, Your Honor. But one more thing I will add. Both the unions and the railroads have members who sit on the NRAB. And those are the people who are the true experts in board procedures. And so, you know, if you're proceeding with a case, you can just speak to your board member if you have questions about these things. That's in the statute. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Monroe. Mr. Hagan?
I have only a brief period of time. The court certainly has power to review arbitration awards that don't draw their essence from the collective bargaining agreement. That's what MISCO says. That's what this circuit has said over and over in cases like Ryan Wilson versus, I've forgotten the particular railroad, but we cited in our brief. This circuit has said that the wards have to draw their essence from the collective bargaining agreement, and the board cannot make up new rules that are not in the collective bargaining agreement. There is no rule like this in the collective bargaining agreement. There is no rule like this in Circular 1. This is a Rule 12b-6 motion we're appealing from, and counsel is arguing at great length about what goes on and what doesn't go on. All of those facts should be inferred in our favor in this appeal from a Rule 12b-6 dismissal. I vehemently disagree with the way my colleague characterized how this process goes before the NRAB. If they had objected when we sent the letter of intent, we would have had the evidence in. If they want to hold off and object at the hearing stage, fine. Let them hold off till the hearing stage, but then let us present the evidence. And the arbitrator in this case refused to take evidence that the arbitrator said, however persuasive, and the arbitrator knew it was persuasive, that conferences had occurred, he wouldn't take it and he'd dismiss these cases with prejudice without a hearing. That's unfair. Thank you.
One question, if I may. Mr. Kagan, and perhaps I've misconstrued the comments by both of you, but historically the fact seems to be drawn that we have before us something, in your view, that was unique, that hasn't happened before.
Yes.
Am I to understand that Mr. Monroe says that that is not the case? I mean, I guess I'm just asking where you draw your historical fact.
Here's how I draw it. The district court, by the way, said there's no precedent for this. She said you could put together two lines of precedents to come up with this idea that it has to be in the record, but she examined the same cases and said, no, none of those holdings that he cites says that. That's just wrong, what counsel said. But I'd like the court to understand that arbitrators go the other way. These arbitration awards, it's stated over and over again, are not precedent. They're not even codified. We don't even know where they are. They rely upon awards that come from other divisions in which the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers doesn't appear. And if you look at the awards, some of them just go completely the opposite way. We cited one in our brief where the arbitrator said, look, if the parties didn't conference, just go back and hold the conference. I'll keep the case here. Come back and see me later. There is no rule from the arbitration awards. And 90% of his presentation to you was just his statements of facts about what goes on in the process that just aren't true. Just not true.
Well, it's not particularly helpful to us, and I don't mean to address this to you or to Mr. Monroe, when we're confronted with a situation about the practice in an area. I mean, it's just distressing to me, and I can't speak for my colleagues, where you have such a diametrically opposed view as to practice. I guess we'll just have to examine it. It's just saddening for me. I'm not questioning either of your credibility or presentation, but it's not helpful when we have a 180-degree difference, not on the law, but sort of on what time of day it is and where the moon is.
I understand, Judge, and we could the issue
I'm
is...
I'm not asking for supplemental.
I understand.
It is what it is, and the court will just have to deal with it. I'm just sharing an observation after the oral argument.
Okay. Thanks, Judge.
All right. Thank you to both counsel. Case is taken under advisement.